Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a title, which is Who Was David Ferry? This will be part three. This will be the final version. I'm going to read from the HSCA, the House Senate Committee on Assassinations, Select Committee on Assassinations. Actually, this was something released in 2017, the raw files. And it's interesting, too, to read through this because some of this material in this did not make it into the HSCA report. So it's almost kind of like the raw files. It makes me think of like the, the history of Hitler's kind of the mind of Adolf Hitler, where they had an 800-page raw file on him. And then they wrote everything together by, using that 800-page file. So it feels like this is the same thing. But there is important information in this. I do have some slides as well that I can just bring up, but they're just specific slides about this whole situation with David Ferry and who was he? And one really just flat out says that he is a CIA agent working for the CIA. And I think that's important because I was reading another book. It's about the JFK aftermath hit list by Richard Belzer and David Wayne. And they claim supposedly David Ferry was a CIA agent, but in here they flat out stated, which is interesting. And just shows like some people don't have all the information on a certain subject. It's really just that simple. It's not like they're gatekeepers or limited hangouts. Some of these analyses of some of these researchers aren't correct. Just because somebody doesn't put the information in, they overlook it or they don't feel it's important or it's not their focus. And I think this is an example. And I think Ferry is overlooked, but I'm also going to go to a very long discussion Jim Garrison had with Playboy magazine in 67 or 68. It's literally like 26 or 27 pages, but he has some insights from him, firsthand insights from Garrison on Ferry. And I think it's interesting too. That whole article, I should read the article. It'd probably be a copyright issue, but it's interesting. It shows how astute Garrison was and how he had his facts down and how he could talk off the top of his head without notes on all those subjects. The guy was amazing. But I'm going to go through this. A lot of hypnotism and some kind of dark stuff. There's this one article about Ferry. Like, he was rumored amongst his many practices, he was a pornographer. He was trading in pornography. And this is one. I don't know who it's to. It's just in there. It's just, "Dear bastard, got your letter from December 30th. Did you get my Christmas letter and the letter with the airline pictures? You did not say, so I was not sure whether you got them or not. One of my flight students loaned me some sex movies for one night. It's just two reels of 8mm film with some guy having sex with this woman. It gets very graphic." And then he talks about drugs, so he's clearly using drugs. "That Cloud 9 you sent was tops. Was it? What is it? Can you send more? If you have any to pay for it, let me know and I'll send the dough. Bring plenty when you get back. Have you ever tried pills? There's a bunch of different ones. Some make you get on Cloud 9 too. Send me some if you can't accept more than last time. The weather continues at its worst. I am losing money like a MF-er. I hope this stuff stops soon." And he talks about his plane. "What time do you get back to New Orleans?" I don't know who that's to. But some of these people also, there's like arrest records. Patrick Martins and Alvin Roland Bobo, both have passed away, but they were involved with him, but were arrested after the assassination of JFK. And this is kind of what they look like. Like, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see these kind of articles. New Orleans DA subpoenas man held after assassination. That's Leighton Martins. And this is what he looked like at the time, 1967. You can see that he's being arrested. Younger guy, 20 at the time, I believe, something like that. He's passed away. He died in 2000. He was 57, but a New Orleans guy through and through. He was a musician, JFK figure. Leighton Patrick Martin, M-A-R-T-E-N-S. And this is an interesting thing. I forgot which book this is from, but it's basically a page from Martin's 1967 letter to Sergio Arcacha Smith and from Robert F. Kennedy. And he's saying that Garrison wants this information from Martin's, But it's, I wanted to tell you this and I almost forgot. Remember the letter from Robert Kennedy, the one that said it was okay for us to do what you were doing. It was stolen with my briefcase in 1961 from Ferry's house. Garrison is looking for that letter. I think he will use it to hurt us and Senator Kennedy if he finds it. I think I know who has it, but I cannot find him. So, like, things were stolen with him and Ferry. But yeah. And then Alvin Albelboof, I think he took the mysterious drive with Ferry to Houston to the skating rink, supposedly go skating. He just passed away last year, January 2nd, 2023. But yeah, there's just more stories. Landry, who got hypnotized, and this is in the files. And there's another one, a younger guy. His name was Dumas, got hypnotized. He had sex with Ferry. And then just more hypnotization. This is the article, the one that says, Ferry at this time told him he was working for the CIA, rescuing Cubans out of Castro's prison in Cuba. So it's kind of validates this, but this is in the files and I'll read that. But it's just interesting to see these kind of raw files. The raw investigative files, I think, give you a good idea of what Ferry was all about. And so some things are overlooked. Like, I've never heard somebody ask or talk about the hypnosis angle of Ferry. And we're going to talk about Oswald getting hypnotized at the Carousel Club, which is where Jack Ruby knew. And so all these guys are overlapping with each other. And Ferry's clearly lying about his knowledge of Oswald, in my opinion. I don't think it's even my opinion. I think he's objectively knows he cannot be connected to Oswald in any way, shape, or form, and is lying about it. So let's go down here. So this is the arrest record, 1964. Named subjects, Alvin Boboff, who we just went, Leighton Martins, and David Ferry, all arrested, 64. Boboff was 20, Martins 18, Ferry 46 at the time. On the midnight of November 24th, 1963, officers Comstock, Iva, and Niedermeyer, John Allen Williams, met Assistant District Attorney Frank Klein in the office of the District Attorney. That time, Mr. Klein began an investigation as to the possibility of David Ferry being involved in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which had occurred in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, by the hands of Lee Harvey Oswald. Information had been brought to the attention of Mr. Klein that David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald had been friends and associates in the past. Yeah, no doubt about it. With this information, at about shortly after midnight, these officers went to 3330 Louisiana Avenue Parkway, knocked on the door, and same was opened by a subject who identified himself as Alvin Boboff. The officers requested the present whereabouts of David Ferry, and Boboff said he did not know. It was obvious he was trying to conceal the facts. He was placed under arrest, and the officers went up to the second-story apartment where they found Leighton Martins seated in a chair. The subject was questioned, and he stated he was presently living with Ferry. However, he did not know the present whereabouts of Ferry. Martins, too, was placed under arrest, and the officers instituted a search. In this residence was found the Smith & Wesson 38 caliber, 5-inch barrel, 6-shot revolver, a holster for this revolver, a 22 cal Hamilton rifle, a large-bore English Army type of knife, so a lot of months. Martins denied the ownership of these items, stating they belonged to Ferry. Martins and Boboff were conveyed to the district police station, and a continuous stakeout was placed on 3330 Louisiana Avenue Parkway. Numerous locations in the city were checked in an attempt to locate Ferry. All were negative. At about 4:30 p.m. on this date, 11/25/63, David Ferry appeared in the office of the district attorney with his attorney, Mr. G. Ray Gill. So he worked as a researcher for G. Ray Gill, and also G. Ray Gill worked for Carlos Marcello. At this time, he was questioned by Mr. Klein and Officer Comstock. He was allowed to see a photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald, and he denied ever seeing this man before. He related a story of having left New Orleans at about 9 a.m. Friday, November 22, 1963, to go to Houston, Texas, on the following day to Galveston, Texas, and returning to New Orleans about 1 a.m. on 11/25/63. Ferry was placed under arrest after his interview and booked in the 1st District Police Station, as stated above. Colonel Garrison of the Department of Public Safety, Texas Ranger, so this is not the same Garrison, I believe, was contacted by telephone by Mr. Klein, and the details surrounding the arrest of Ferry were given to him. His office conducted a preliminary investigation. However, they were unable to implicate the subject in the assassination of President Kennedy. 11/26/63, Captain Priest of the Houston Police Department Detective Bureau was contacted by telephone and asked to verify the movements which Ferry described relative to him being in the state of Texas. After several hours, Captain Priest notified this office that the results of his investigation, which corroborated the story related by Ferry, in that Ferry arrived in Houston on 11/23/63 and made a visit to a skating rink owned by an individual named Roland. Captain Priest was also able to corroborate Ferry's story as to him being in Galveston, Texas the following day. The officers have been unable to uncover any evidence which would link Ferry to the assassination of Kennedy. So that was the report. This is an FBI report taken November 27th. And Garrison was not happy with the FBI, so he kind of had some sensibility that, you know, the FBI was not properly investigating Ferry, which was correct. David Pierce Magyar, chief pilot, seaplane division, traveled to Mexico, vice state of Mexican got aerial survey during a camp. Magyar advised that he was personally acquainted with Captain Dave Ferry, but that this relationship was very casual, as he did not consider Ferry to be a close personal friend. He advised that Ferry was a former Eastern Airlines pilot who about 10 years ago was in charge of the Civil Air Patrol unit, which held meetings at Moisant Airport. He recalls that Ferry seemed to be able to handle young boys very well, but does not know whether Lee Harvey Oswald was a member of the Civil Air Patrol at the time. He advised that George Piazza, 539 Clay Henry Avenue, Henry Clay Avenue, was one of Captain David Ferry's best friends and would probably able to furnish any pertinent information regarding Ferry that was needed. Magyar was under the impression that Piazza was a former member of the Civil Air Patrol, and probably a member at the same time Lee Harvey Oswald was allegedly a member. Lee Harvey Oswald was a member. They just didn't know it at the time. He also advised that a Leon Guidry, presently residing in New Orleans, exact address unknown, was in the Civil Air Patrol at the same time as Captain Dave Ferry. From what we could recall, Guidry was the cadet captain in the Civil Air Patrol, in charge of all cadets, and would probably recall all other members of the Civil Air Patrol. So it was just kind of an investigative report. This is Ferry being in Galveston, Texas. This is 1963. November 28th, Lee Fletcher, Porter, Allen Motel made available to the registration card for the following 23rd of November, which reflected the following information. D.W. Ferry, Alvin Belboeuf, Booboeuf, and Melvin Coffey checked into room 19. November 23rd, 1963, and stayed till the evening of November 24th. While at the motel, Ferry made the following telephone calls: New Orleans, UE, New Orleans, and then two calls to WHO radio and WDSH radio. Very weird. The Winterland Skating Rink was the name of it. Mr. Ferry stated he was coming in from out of town and desired to do some skating while in Houston. On November 23, 1963, between 3:30 and 5:30 p.m., Mr. Ferry and two companions came to the Winterland Skating Rink and talked to Mr. Roland. Mr. Ferry had a short general conversation with Mr. Roland, but at no time did they discuss the cost of equipping or operating an ice skating rink. Mr. Ferry stated to Mr. Roland that he and his companions would be in and out of the skating rink during the weekend. This is the last time Mr. Roland saw Ferry or his companions. And then it's surmised that Ferry was there to take people from Houston and fly them over the border to Mexico at night. That's a rumor. But yeah, these are more of those investigations of David William Ferry. It is interesting. Just all these little memorandums and people. William Gervich was a short-time investigator for Garrison, and I think didn't last very long. But he was involved. This is a Federal Bureau of Investigation report, November 27, 63. David William Ferry was interviewed at his residence, 3330 Louisiana Avenue Parkway, and was advised of the identity of the interviewing agents. He was advised he did not have to make a statement, that any statement he did make could be used in a court of law, and he had the right to the advice of an attorney. Ferry stated that at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, he was very embarrassed and concerned over the lack of air cover provided to the Cubans who were engaged in the invasion, and that he severely criticized President John F. Kennedy both in public and in private. He stated he does not recall specifically what he said in making these criticisms and might have used an offhand or colloquial expression of "he ought to be shot" to express his feelings concerning the Cuban situation. He stated that he has never made any statement that President Kennedy should be killed with the intention that this be done, and has never at any time outlined or formulated any plans or made any statement as to how this could be done or who should do it. Ferry stated that when it came to serious discussions, when the question of impeachment of President Kennedy arose, he opposed any impeachment proceedings. Ferry said that within 1 year prior to the first Russian Sputnik, he recalls being quite critical of the U.S. space project and the defense program. He said he had also been critical of any president riding in an open car, and he made the statement that anyone could hide in the bushes and shoot a president. Ferry also advised that he has been accused of being a worshiper of President Kennedy because he is a liberal and strongly believes in President Kennedy's civil rights program and fiscal program. Ferry stated he has never loaned his library card to Lee Harvey Oswald or any other person at any time, and that his library card, to the best of his recollection, has not been out of his possession since it was issued to him. He exhibited New Orleans Public Library card number 89437 bearing the stamp lettering NRPD in the upper left-hand corner. Ferry said the letters NR mean non-resident and the letters PD mean paid. He related that at the time he obtained this library card, he was living in Metairie, Louisiana, and had to pay for the issuance of the card. The library card shows it was issued in the name of Dr. David Ferry, 331 Atherton Avenue. The expiration date is shown as March 13, 63. Ferry stated that he has no recollection of knowing or having met Lee Harvey Oswald in the Civil Air Patrol or in any business or social capacity. He's lying. Ferry stated he has never owned a telescopic sight, a rifle equipped with a telescopic sight, has never used a weapon equipped with a telescopic sight, or does not know how to use one. I think he's lying there too. He also said he has never instructed Lee Harvey Oswald or anyone else in the use of American-made or foreign-made rifles or firearms. Ferry said that while in the Civil Air Patrol, he assisted in firearms instruction at the Civil Air Patrol bivouacs for range safety only. Ferry claimed he's owned a Stinson 150 blue and white single-engine four-passenger monoplane, registration number 8293K, and that his plane has not been airworthy since the license expired in the spring of 1962. Ferry stated he has never flown Lee Harvey Oswald to Dallas, Texas, or any other town in Texas at any time. He said that the only planes he would have access to would be rental planes. And there's another investigative piece by the FBI. One of these interesting documents is from an independent researcher. His name was Jones Harris, who was a independent JFK researcher. And he says, he adds all these names that are pretty interesting. Nagel, guys who were CIA. Nagel gave Harris info following two he said at hand in Dallas, both working as an outfit for the Movement to Free Cuba, headed by Tracy Barnes, known CIA agent. And one is Leopoldo and Rangel, both ex-CIA. And then Ferry knew both of those two people. So Ferry was CIA and knew a lot of those people. Nagel left New Orleans for home on September 16th, 1963. So there's a lot of different things. And then there's a listing of witnesses. A lot of these people who may have known it. Leighton Martins is in there. There's a lot of teenagers, a lot of kids. More investigative reports by Gervich. It's kind of been discredited. This is just kind of different people involved. Traveling. It's about Sergio Arcacha Smith, too, who is kind of in this same group. And then there's like, apparently, Ferry was sending out mailings and things like that. He was sending off personal things. This is another one. He was sending off letters to people. But this is another one. Dick Billings, Haskell, February 14, 1963, 67, NBC and David William Ferry. Barnes said Bob Mulholland of NBC News Chicago talked in Dallas to one Ferry a narcotics addict now out on bail on a sodomy charge in Dallas. Ferry said that Oswald had been under hypnosis from a man doing a mind reading act at Ruby's Carousel, right? Carousel Club. That's a known one. So Ferry says that Oswald was under hypnosis. So anybody can find the guy doing mind reading act at Ruby's Carousel Club. I'll send you a free book. Ferry was said to be a private detective and the owner of an airplane who took young boys on flights just for kicks. Above Barnes is Gene Barnes of NBC, West Coast cameraman. Bob Mulholland is now producer of the Huntley Brinkley Show in Washington. I spoke with Mulholland. Mulholland said he remembered something about a guy with an airplane, that the name Ferry or Ferry was familiar, and that he had a vague memory of someone flying guns to Cuba and queers. Mulholland, however, did not speak to anyone in Dallas as he was busy with the NBC crews and did not recognize the picture of Ferry. He recalled he probably heard the above from John Corporon of NBC News New Orleans. Mulholland said that Corporon called him and told him about Ferry, and shortly thereafter, the FBI visited Mulholland. He remembers the story because the FBI visit because that is when he discovered his phone was tapped. Valeriani and Fisher remember the incident. I called John Corporon, who is now with WNEW TV News in New York. He remembers the story very well. Quote, "We got an anonymous tip and one from a former assistant DA about this man who had an airplane and that this man was due in Texas on November 22nd. This man, Ferry, had known Oswald in the Civil Air Patrol. He was probably a homosexual. There was something about a rendezvous having been arranged to fly Oswald out of the country," unquote. Corporon then says he called Garrison to find out about the tip. "I didn't have too much success." He then called Mulholland in Dallas. Soon after that call, he too received a visit from the FBI. Garrison then arrested Ferry. On Monday, Ferry called Corporon and said he had seen him giving editorials on TV and he wanted to talk. Corporon went over to the jail. He remembers Ferry had a migraine headache. He also remembers, quote, "he was an odd duck," unquote. They talked for 1.5 hours, and Ferry convinced Corporon that someone had very cleverly linked Ferry to Oswald, knowing it looked believable. Ferry was quite upset. When Corporon left the cell, the Secret Service went in. After them, the FBI talked with Ferry. And after them, Garrison's men went in. Corporon was the first to talk with Ferry. Ferry was working as a private investigator for a prominent New Orleans lawyer, C. G. Ray Gill. I think Gill got him released and then fired him. Ferry called me a couple of times after that, protesting his innocence. The story continued to intrigue me, so we tried to follow it up. But then we decided there was nothing to pursue and gave up. Personally, I think Garrison arrested Ferry in order to make himself famous, but maybe the FBI asked Garrison to make the arrest because they didn't want to be involved if the accusation turned out to be false, which it did. Corporon was in a hurry, and he was also rather curious why I was so interested in Ferry. I didn't want to pursue it too far in case he might call my attention to any of his friends in New Orleans. Too bad. It looks like by the time the story got to it, Barnes had it. It had been added to mind reading stories, etc. And the FBI, knowing all about Ferry anyway, just discounted it. As far as I can find, Ferry's name is not mentioned anywhere in the Warren Commission books or the National Archives Index of material received from the Commission or the FBI Secret Service. Interesting. I wonder if he's mentioned in the Warren Commission. This is February 28, 1967. Louis Ivan from Sergeant Fenner. This is after Ferry's death. I think Ferry died February 22nd, 67. About 3:15 p.m., February 24th, 1967, I interviewed Roy Tell at his residence. Roy Tell stated that he had not heard from David Ferry since around New Year's, 1967, at which time they exchanged greetings at the New Orleans airport. He explains that he had been closely associated with Ferry back in the late 50s while he was executive secretary of the Civil Air Patrol, Moissant Division. He explains that Ferry was a devout Catholic and insisted that the boys attend their church. Ferry often referred the boys to Father Sebastian Arganello, who may be in New Orleans at this time. However, was located in Raceland, Louisiana. It was at Our Lady of Perpetual Help in Kenner, Louisiana. Ferry also referred to the Catholic Church as being communistic and talked about the merits of communism. Reutel remembered receiving a telephone call from Ferry shortly after the president's assassination, and Ferry explained to him that he was working with the FBI, was seeking information as to Oswald, and also wanted to locate Edward Vobel and George Walters. Reutel remembered the name Oswald as being in the Civil Air Patrol, but could not place him. He was going to check at his mother's house and see if he could find any old records or photographs relating to any of these individuals. The following individuals were named by Tell as being closely associated with David Ferry: Oliver St. P., now in the Peace Corps somewhere in Asia; Larry Anderson, pilot for Delta Airlines; Thomas Nation Compton III. Ferry referred to Compton as an undisciplined genius; Melvin Coffey, maybe at Mashoud; Gene and Richard Marshall. Gene is traveling as a musician, and Richard is working at Mashoud. This is March 10th, 67. Interview Thomas Compton. Thomas Compton, Mr. Compton stated he was a member of the Moissant Wing of the Civil Air Patrol from 1954 to January 1958. He was acquainted with David Ferry on and off for approximately 10 years. On one occasion, he visited Ferry at a residence on Vinette Street, and another single visit in Airline Park. Mr. Compton stated that in the spring of 1964, he stopped for gas in a service station on the Veterans Highway. And again met David Ferry. Mr. Compton related that after learning Dave Ferry and Al Landry owned this station, he obtained a part-time job as an attendant. After working a short period and unable to collect his pay and not being relieved on duty by Landry, he decided to quit. While employed at this service station, he helped David Ferry tow his airplane over to the station. The aircraft was in terrible condition, more so from vandals than deterioration or wear or tear. Mr. Compton stated the last time he knew of David Ferry's plane flying was 1957, and rumors same up to 1961. Mr. Compton further stated that sometime before the assassination of President Kennedy, he drove Dave Ferry to Camp Street across from the Lafayette Square to Guy Bannister's office. Guy Bannister and Dave Ferry then went to a coffee shop on the corner and talked over a beverage. Mr. Compton related that he sat at another table in this establishment and did not hear any of the conversation. Also, he could not remember how long before the assassination this took place. Mr. Compton continued to state that on Sunday after the assassination at 5:30 a.m., he was awakened by Dave Ferry in his dormitory bed at the University of Southeastern in Hammond, Louisiana. Mr. Compton stated that until this day, he is uncertain how Dave Ferry located him on this date. At this time, Dave Ferry was in hysterics and near tears, and he stated, "The police are at my home and have taken some of my things." Compton stated that Dave Ferry did not elaborate on my things and stated that Ferry also related he didn't do anything wrong. The two talked for a while on different unrelated subjects, and then Ferry made two calls to New Orleans, and Compton believed they were to G.W. Gill, attorney at law. Compton stated that Dave Ferry left at approximately 8:30 a.m. the same morning, and it is believed that he returned to New Orleans in a Ford Falcon station wagon. Compton stated that Dave Ferry did not tell him he had been to Texas. Compton stated he never met Lee Harvey Oswald, and also that he could not connect him in any way with CAP. The only knowledge of Oswald was from Mr. Bill Wolf, who headed the New Orleans Astronomers Club. In 1956, Lee Harvey Oswald attempted to join this club and submitted an application which was refused. Compton related that after the assassination, Mr. Wolf turned over this application to the FBI. It just goes on. Mr. Compton stated that Dave Ferry had never mentioned the name of Clay Shaw to him. Compton did recall that after Clay Shaw was arrested, the meeting of he and Dave Ferry in Hammond, and thought about this being the hometown of Shaw's parents. Interesting. And then this is Dean Andrews, right? Pipe the Bimbo in red. Dean Andrews had information that Lee Harvey Oswald frequented the Society Page Bar, 100 block of Exchange Place. He suggested we speak to the following people. Also, Andrews suggested we speak to a man by the name of Wright. This is the same individual who struck the reporter outside of Clay Shaw's apartment on the night it was searched. His full name and address can be ascertained from police records, since he was charged with simple battery as a result of the aforementioned incident. And then there's other statements. This is Thomas Lewis Clark, age 19. He was kind of related to the whole thing about the filling station. Dave sold the filling station and asked me if I wanted to work with him as a flight instructor at the airport. He was working for Saturn Aviation at that time. I agreed to more or less hung around out there, and there wasn't much to do. He quit and opened his own flight school. He asked me to work with him there. This was 1966. I lived with Dave at one time for about 2 months. This was right before he died. I have been to his apartment quite a few times. Question, did Dave ever talk to you about his activities, flying to Cuba, the Bahamas? Answer, he told me once he went to the Bahamas. Question, did he do much talking about the investigation of the Kennedy assassination? Answer, he said something about you all didn't know what you were doing. He was in bed, sick. That's another one. This is Al Alser, interview of Charles Holliday. Holliday stated he was a member of CAP, the New Orleans Airport Squadron, from 1954 to 1956. He then went active duty in the U.S. Air Force. Mr. Holliday related that he knew Dave Ferry from being a member of the CAP. Further, that Ferry was a weird character. He heard that later Mr. Ferry was with an airlines. The only thing that stood out was the fact that Ferry mentioned several times that he had a drug or a combination of drugs that he could take and no doctor could say he didn't die a natural death. Mr. Holliday related that he never did personally see David Ferry mix any drugs. He also stated that he had never gone to Dave Ferry's house. Mr. Holliday stated that five or six boys were close to Ferry, and one of them was Tommy Bowman, who at the present time is not residing in New Orleans, and it is unknown where he is now residing. Also, a Mr. Penegai, Charlie Robertson, and Phil Cousins. Mr. Holliday stated that Mr. Holliday stated Mr. Drewer would have pictures of the entire group because she was always there when they were on maneuvers and inspections. Mr. was the commanding officer of the female CAP. Captain Ferry would tell them that they were training for guerrilla warfare because this was the most effective way to take over a country. The group had rifles to train with that had lead poured into the barrels. Just more stuff. To Jim Garrison, interview of Mike Finney. So all these guys just knew stuff about Ferry. The squadron. Finney was shown pictures of Oswald, Clayshaw, Guy Bannister, and several others. He could only identify David Ferry. Lou Ivan, past, present addresses of David Ferry. So they had all that down. And then the interview with Reverend Arjonia. Talked about Ferry and his mentality and all these things. Let's see. Past the dead end. Talk about all this stuff. Like, it goes in deep. It goes about his religious views. He classed himself as a psychologist in the directory, and his main living was derived from flying, piloting, and aircraft. It talks about it. Was Ferry ever in the company of someone when he came to visit you? Was he always by himself? Father, yes, always by himself. He really gives an impression. He comes to church in a uniform. He gives a very good impression. What kind of uniform was he wearing? Black? Father, black, sometimes jet black, when he was in the service at the airport in the airlines. Regular commercial line uniform? It never rang a bell when this person did. Did you ever notice his eyebrows appeared to be glued on or painted or makeup on his face? Father, no, I didn't notice. This was 11 years ago. So it looks like he lost his hair sometime in the 50s. Somebody asked me that question. What church was Ferry buried at? Way down in Chalmette. Only two people showed up for the funeral. Down in Chalmette, he got buried in the St. Bernard Memorial. You see, what you've come and told me just now, I never knew the Ferry that came to see me was the same. Well, you probably wouldn't have recognized this picture. Niedermeyer, something happened to all his hair. He was balder than a cue ball. He pasted his eyebrows on. So that was it. There's a picture of Ferry, too. This is the investigation of Ferry by Eastern Airlines. So they had all of the material here. And you can read through this. I'm not going to do it. I don't have the time. But Ferry's fighting back. He's not in compliance, or he's not on board with the investigation. He keeps referring to his lawyer, G. Gill, right, who's in there. It's the same person who represents Representative Marcello. So very close. They're trying. It's not a criminal investigation. It's about his arrest, right? They're just going back and forth. Bell is the attorney for Eastern and Gill. But they're spending a lot of time. Like, this is a full deposition. It got pretty intense. And my understanding is that Ferry actually ended because Ferry was definitely having sex with boys, but denied it here. Then they never fired him or something. And then he got a payout from Eastern, I think. So he was a bit of a sharp customer, a scoundrel. And then later on in this, it's pretty evident that, I mean, for me, my reading of this is that Ferry is going to the witnesses and intimidating them or paying them off or something like that. So it's pretty incredible. But here's his William Ferry application for employment. They had all that, his background, his educational background, his height, 180 pounds. He claimed to have excellent health at that time. This is his flying application, summary of employment. I mean, there's tons of paperwork. This whole inquiry was really something else. And then there was like reasons for leaving the, you know, seminary. I mean, the question is really, well, what was he doing? Like, I think that he was, this is the interview of Ferry. I read this. That was for David Ferry part one, right? So that was it. This is NPR Collect, New Orleans, Garrison Plot, take two. Ben Kate asked me to send full particulars on David William Ferry. So this is New York, David Snyder, Time Stringer in New Orleans, right? So this is a Times reporter who was there when Ferry was being interviewed by Garrison and then died. So he's following him. Now I'll read this. My first contact with Ferry was a telephone call at 5:30 p.m. Friday, February 17th. He died February 22nd, right? Following the appearance of the state's item's initial story on the Garrison investigation, he had read the story and he said was tired of remaining silent on the investigation. He felt he was being persecuted by the DA's office and he was afraid of arrest. Ferry's voice was nasal and almost inaudible. He said he was physically sick. During our first telephone conversation, his breathing was unsteady. I asked Ferry when I could see him. He told me to make it soon because he might have to change his mind about talking. I told him I would be by his house at 6 p.m. I talked to him for 4.5 hours Friday night. He called me at least once every day after that until his death. He was extremely sick, he said, with encephalitis. He was scared to death of arrest by the district attorney's office, and he was bitterly convinced that there was no justice for him in this world. The man investigated on two different occasions by the DA's office in connection with the assassination met me at the downstairs entrance to his apartment at 3330 Louisiana Avenue. His steps were feeble as we climbed the stairs to the second floor. He apologized for the slowness, saying he was suffering from encephalitis, but assured me that it was not contagious. He also apologized for the condition of the apartment. He said the place was being renovated. The living room was heavy with the smell of stale cigarettes. Every ashtray was heaped with cigarette butts. Furniture, greasy from sweat and dirt, rested on a littered, threadbare carpet. An American flag stood in one corner. Next to it was a typewriter in a case. Dr. Nicholas Chetta, New Orleans Parish Coroner, said tests showed that the suicide note found in the apartment was typed on the typewriter. It's my theory that Ferry had just about decided on suicide at the time he called me Friday. He may have had the note written. When I talked to him, especially on the phone, it seems to me in retrospect that Ferry just wanted to clear himself, then cash in. But by the time we had finished our conversation, he had perked up a little. He said he would like to file a suit that would allow him to subpoena Garrison and expose the harassment he, Ferry, was going through. I encouraged him because I thought it would be a good story if he did file a suit. By the time I left his apartment, he was saying that he would prepare a suit over the weekend to file Monday. He called Sunday to say he planned to get together with an attorney on the suit. He said he was feeling better and sounded better. By Monday, he was working in an attorney's office trying to get the suit together. The target of the suit was vague, but one of those sued would apparently be Jack Martin, a nut and self-styled private detective who, he said, had supplied Garrison a list of names, both in 1963 and the last year, to check out in connection with the assassination. Ferry's name was on both lists. By this time, Ferry was ready, reading every scrap on the Garrison probe and taking almost a happy-go-lucky attitude toward the investigation. It is well known in New Orleans that there is a rift between the FBI office and the DEA's office. Ferry had been down to the FBI office Monday, he said, to talk to the agents. One of the agents told him, "I know where you were the day Kennedy was assassinated. You were cooling your heels with me in federal district court." This is mentioned in an earlier file. Ferry said the FBI boys were chuckling about the Garrison investigation. Ferry asked me if I could find out exactly when Oswald was in New Orleans. He said he needed the information for his suit. I looked up the dates in a condensation of the Warren report and gave it to him. But he said he was having trouble getting the suit together, but it was apparently occupying most of his day. He talked to my wife on Tuesday. He had a new theory on the trajectory of the bullets that entered Kennedy's body. He wanted to take me to a toxicology lab to show me that he was talking what he was talking about with a cadaver. He also complained of headaches. By now, he had stopped asking me if I thought he would be arrested. He had become almost like a spectator as far as the Garrison investigation was concerned. He oozed good-natured confidence. I talked to him Tuesday evening, and he had been watching a TV news show with interest. He was in a good mood. Wednesday, he was dead. The change in attitude over the space of almost a week leads me to believe that he was at a low ebb when he called, but had decided to live and fight back after all. For this reason, natural death immediately made more sense than suicide. He left a long note, only two paragraphs of which have been made public. It has been described as philosophical in nature. The center of things in Ferry's apartment was a coffee table placed in front of the couch. It held an overloaded ashtray and a cluster of bottles containing pills and liquid medicine. The DA's office said 15 bottles of medicine were found in the apartment. I would say there were that many on the table. On Friday, at least, it was the room of a man who had given up. Ferry either propped himself against the arm of the sofa or reclined full length against two soiled pillows as he related the details of troubles he had reduced him from a man of means to poverty. It is a matter of record that Ferry was arrested in 1961 on a morals charge in Jefferson Parish with committing a crime against nature and indecent behavior with juveniles. New Orleans police reported Ferry had attempted to intimidate one witness, a 16-year-old boy, who told officers that he signed a paper promising not to prefer charges against Ferry. Other youths told police Ferry took them on airline flights to Houston and Corpus Christi, Texas, on different occasions. One boy told officers he had flown to Cuba with Ferry, and another reported to police that Ferry had asked him to drive a Cuban citizen to Miami. Ferry was not convicted. All of the charges were null prost, so nulle prosequi, right? The DA chose not to prosecute. But about this time, Ferry was bumped from the payroll of Eastern Airlines, where he had been a respected pilot. In our conversation, Ferry contended, this is a 4.5 hour conversation. In our conversation, Ferry contended he was framed by Jefferson Parish authorities. And in fact, authorities tried to shake him down for $5,000 to drop the matter. Ferry was bitter at the world. He said the courts offered no justice, that the federal government offered no protection to citizens. From time to time, he broke out into an almost nonstop narrative of his troubles to lash out at the law, at justice, and the news media. His head covered with a wig that was a rusty shade of red, his shoes off, and a cigarette or cup of coffee constantly in his hand, Ferry talked on and on. Once he questioned the Warren Commission report on the trajectory of the bullets that crashed into Kennedy's body, he dragged books on anatomy and physiology from a back room and launched into a medical dissertation on the assassination. He seemed to know the human body like his living room, and you caught flashes of brilliance as he expounded on his theories. It was because of his knowledge of science that he had become a part-time investigator. Ferry is a pilot, he told me, but in complex cases involving science, several attorneys have found it advantageous to have me investigate for them. He worked for top attorneys in town, such as G. Ray Gill, defense lawyer for mafia character Carlos Marcello. But whatever else he was, Ferry was respected as an investigator and a pilot. He was considered by several people around town as tops, as a flyer, and an instructor. Ferry would have been 49 years old in March. The reason for the Texas trip on the day Kennedy was shot, said Ferry, was a spur-of-the-moment thing. One guy remembered there was an ice skating rink in Houston, so he decided to go skating. This version is disputed by one of the two persons who went with Ferry. He said the trip was planned for a week and no hunting equipment was taken, was Ferry's claim. Ferry's mind dwelled on arrest. He said several times he wanted me to arrange a lie detector test for him in case he was hauled in. I asked Ferry if he thought the Garrison investigation was a phony. Why, certainly, he said. How could it be anything else? Again, he said, my assessment of Oswald is such that he would be incapable of conspiring because he would be incapable of any interpersonal relationship. Strange thing to say. Especially in anything such as delicate as a conspiracy to kill. Only a nut would be a co-conspirator because he was so erratic. Of the investigation, Ferry said, psychologically, I think it's an utter waste of time. I understand that Tonight Television carried a story quoting a doctor who treated Ferry, saying that Ferry had been extremely sick 3 weeks before he called the paper. The doctor said Ferry decided to call me at the newspaper because his friends had stopped calling him. When he called to find out why, they told him the DA had been talking to them. This was apparently the last straw. TV also quotes the doctor as being told by Ferry that he wanted to file a $5 million lawsuit against Garrison. Ferry told me the suit would be against Jack Martin, whom he said started everything, and United Press International for something they had carried. I am vague on this point. One more point, Ferry was listed in the city directory as a psychologist. Regards, David Snyder. So that's David Snyder. First-hand account. Billings Haskell to Angeloff. The Army was able to confirm only the barest outline of what you already know about Ferry's military background, but it is a hard confirmation. Listed in the Army Reserves, 1950, he was on active duty till he was discharged in 1953. It says it's very skimpy. That's all the Army has. Two Billings from Chandler, 1967. Let's see. Informant says 1959 to 1961, he was a member of Civilian Air Patrol Group here as a member of the Marine Reserve Unit based at Alvin Callender Field, a Navy research station. He says in 1959, because of CAP connection and electronic training, approached by Ferry, who he knew well, and Arcacho Smith. They asked if he would help training anti-Castro guerrillas being trained by Ferry and Arcacha in an abandoned portion of Callender with live ammunition and M1s and other military ordnance. Informant declined because of his government contracts, but agreed to act as a repository of information for Ferry and Arcacha in case they ever got into trouble and needed somebody to testify of their activities. Because of that relationship, he was kept well posted. He says revolutionaries operated at field under guise of being the CAP group, which they weren't. His Marine Reserve unit at the time was asked to help to train this group, and he personally observed Ferry and Aracho giving rifle training to a group of 20 or so men. At the time, Ferry and Arcacha were also employed by the U.S. immigration to be present anytime groups of Cuban refugees arrived in New Orleans and identify known communists. However, says informant, every time refugee group was due to arrive, Arcacha would be jailed on pretext by New Orleans police, and Ferry would be jailed by Jefferson Parish police, where Ferry resided then. They thus were prevented from identifying incoming Cubans. Informant believes Orleans harassment directed by then District Attorney Richard Dowling and Jeff harassment directed by Sheriff Jack Fitzgerald both had strong Marcello ties. Informant says Jefferson trial of Ferry was a frame. Doesn't know why. Informant phoned one Mike Finney, and also CAP group member, and informant asked Finney, Dave Ferry didn't know Oswald, did he? Finney replied, yeah, sure, and so did I. Informant said these persons were among those being trained as revolutionaries. Rodriguez Johnson, Leighton Martins, we've already gone over Martins. Informant says in this period, Ferry went to Guy Bannister to see if he could get harassment stopped, and Bannister showed Ferry an informant letter from House Un-American Activities, saying then D.A. Dowling was under investigation for communist ties. On behalf of Ferry, informant also talked to FBI locally to attempt to ease harassment and referred to Washington. He was told by somebody in Hoover's office, you had better not get involved in this thing and tell your friends that they'd be better off out of New Orleans. He called Justice Department shortly thereafter and was told the same thing in almost identical words. He had the impression Justice Department had been briefed on him by the Bureau. He took the advice and stopped all intimate association with Ferry and doesn't know what happened to Ferry or Kacha or Cubans thereafter. Informant also said he was told by this period Ferry and Arcacha that illegal Jefferson Gambling Casino Beverly Club was jointly owned by Marcello and Batista, right? He's the former head of Cuba. Informant believes Orlando Piedra of Miami knows details of Marcello Batista Beverly Club arrangement. It's all kinds of intrigue. R says Arcacha worked for both Fulgencia Batista and Fidel Castro. Riley Coffee Company, right? Riley, I think Oswald worked at the Riley Coffee Company at one time. Feed information. It's just a lot of intrigue. It just goes on and on. Dear Dick, this is 1966. Here with a suggestion concerning television ads. Before getting into that, I have a story to tell you which may be no more than interesting gossip. But if life plans to do more on the assassination, it may be worth filing. A New Orleans detective, 12 years on the force, college education, says Oswald was connected with a weirdo pilot who kept a gun arsenal, fake passports, and a library on post-hypnotic suggestion. The detective headed a team which, two nights after Oswald's capture, raided the uptown New Orleans apartment of David Ferry, at the time suspended pilot for Eastern Airlines. Ferry had been under suspension 6 months with no visible income and was awaiting trial on homosexual charges. Ferry, until his, was it the commander of Oswald's small cap group. Oswald was a member in his teens, but the detective says Ferry indicated he knew Oswald during his 1963 residence. So he's Ferry lied to the police, lied to the FBI. They raided the pad and found Ferry absent, but two 17-year-old high school boys there. The boys had in their possession visa applications for South America, and when questioned, handed police a card bearing the name Jack Wasserman, Washington, D.C. attorney for racketeer Carlos Marcello. Police did so, and Wasserman arranged for their parole. The boys told their parents they were members of a martial anti-Castro group organized by Ferry. They were sworn to secrecy and could say no more. The page is missing. This is Al Landry. I think he was a younger guy. Jim Garrison, 1963. Goes into detail, like, I can't believe I could do it for it. But this Landry, Ferry at the time, told him that he was working for the CIA, rescuing Cubans out of Castro's prison in Cuba. So CIA connection, that's Landry. Ferry said there was three branches working for their liberation in Cuba, one in Miami, one in New Orleans, and one in Texas. Landry said that after the Bay of Pigs, Ferry became annoyed with the CIA and often belittled the CIA and President Kennedy. He said the CIA and President Kennedy had screwed the whole invasion up and that they had betrayed the Cuban people by refusing to send the air support that was promised. Landry said that Ferry had a blackboard in his apartment, and he often drew on his blackboard the actual plans for the invasion of Cuba, explaining what the Cubans were supposed to do and at what point the CIA was supposed to send the air support. Landry said he talked as if he knew all about the battle plans and the invasion. Ferry told him of how the boats got in touch with the CIA and requested the air support, and the CIA had Kennedy on the hotline, and how Kennedy was supposed to give the okay for the air support, but he said that Kennedy and the CIA did not intervene like they said they would. The Cubans were promised by the CIA that when the time was right, after some troops had already gotten on the island, they would furnish the air support. Landry said that he can remember going with Arcacha Smith's house on the lakefront somewhere with Ferry and some other people which watched actual films of the invasion. Landry said he joined the service in June 1962 and came out in June of 1966. He said he had no contact with Ferry during that time. He was in the service and not actually had seen him for a few months before he joined. So there's all kinds of contacts and stuff. Was it Jeremy? I don't know who Al Jeremy. So there's all kinds of stuff. Leighton Martins, Lawrence Fox. Solicitation to, there's just a lot of investigative files, really. Investigator Leighton Loisel. This is Ferry. Ferry's, he's also, he seems to be bisexual because he's has, he has these other African American girls. Let's see. Agent number one called Lynn Loisel told him that Dave Ferry and he had gone to an apartment off the Veterans Highway to look at some dirty films last night, that this apartment was one of Carlos Marcello's apartment houses, and the apartment was 18N, but he didn't know the address. He said there was about 15 people present, and he believed that the operator of the show is a Cuban named Carlos. Agent one said he stated there were three color girls whose names were Shwanda, Margaret, and Barbara. He said that Margaret has been with Dave since 1962, and she knows plenty of his associates. Shwanda and Barbara haven't been around that long, and that Margaret was Dave's favorite. He said that David asked him to burglarize this clerk's house because he felt like he could make some easy money. He also said that this clerk always had $1,000 on him and knows he must keep money in this house. Agent one said the clerk was due at the airport Monday, and Dave would get his license plate number, check it out, and find out where the clerk lives. Then they would burglarize the house with Dave acting as the lookout man and Dave going in. Agent one said Ferry put money in the NBC bank yesterday. Agent one said he doesn't know where Ferry gets the money from because Ferry only makes living expenses by teaching student flyers. He's doing something in like underground trafficking. Agent one said Dave was carrying a rifle in his car and said he was going to shoot one of the kids that burglarized his apartment. Loisel asked him when the apartment was burglarized, what was taken. Agent one said it was burglarized a few days ago in two reels of dirty film, a letter of some pictures of Dave having intercourse with the girl Margaret, and a picture of something else. Later on this date, Agent One called me back. The Cuban was out taking a day a few minutes ago. Agent One also said that David Ferry told him that the clerk would be at the airport Saturday, and that Agent One was to burglarize the clerk's house. I mean, these guys are up to all kinds of no good. I'm only halfway through this. This is a letter to Boo Boof, Last Will and Testament, written in 1966. So Alvin Buboff's in there. Just goes on and on. There's some, just a lot of details, a lot of other details about Ferry. I mean, maybe I'll have to do a part four if people are interested. But that's an hour. And I haven't even gotten to Jim Garrison's take on Ferry. Let me see if I can find that. Let's get close this window. Yeah, maybe I can just go through a quickly do this. Let's see. So this is the, you know, back in the day they didn't have the internet, but this is actually interesting because it's a CIA retracted file, proof for release, but it originally published in Playboy October 1967, and a candid conversation with him, Battle District Attorney of New Orleans, and then just kind of like the Ferry materials. See, all right, May 15th issue of Newsweek charged that two of your investigators offered David Ferry's former roommate Alvin Buboff $3,000 and an airline job if he'd help substantiate your charges against Clay Shaw. How do you answer this accusation? Mr. Buboff was one of two men who accompanied David Ferry on a mysterious trip from New Orleans to Texas on the day of the assassination. So naturally, we were interested in him from the very start of our investigation. At first, he showed every willingness to cooperate with our office. But after Ferry's death, somebody gave him a free trip to Washington. From that moment on, a change came over Buboff. He refused to cooperate with us any further, and he made the charges against my investigators to which you refer. Fortunately, Buboff had signed an affidavit on April 12th, well after the alleged bribe offer was supposed to have been made, affirming that no representative of the New Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office had ever asked me to do anything but tell the truth. Any inference or statement by anyone to the contrary has no basis in fact. So that's Alvin Buboff. And then there's a mention of Russo claimed to have attended a meeting at David Ferry's apartment where Shaw, Oswald, and Ferry plotted the assassination. He passed the test. And then there's a lot like Ferry's dead. Regis Kennedy is one of the FBI agents who interrogated David Ferry in November 1963, and I hoped to learn from him what information the Bureau had elicited from Ferry. But on the instructions of our old friend, Attorney General Ramsey Clark, Kennedy refused to answer the questions put to him by the grand jury on the grounds of executive privilege. Warren DeBruce is a former FBI agent based in New Orleans who also questioned Ferry in 1963. Between 1961 and 1963, DeBruys was involved with the anti-Castro exile activities in New Orleans and was seen frequently at the meetings of the right-wing Cuban Democratic Revolutionary Front. So, like, very kind of goes on. Let's see. I can't get into all aspects of Gordon Novel's activities because we have a live case against it. Novel worked closely with David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cuban exiles. In 1961, he raided a munitions bunker in Houma, Louisiana, with David Ferry and a prominent anti-Castro exile leader. And the weapons seized were subsequently shipped by CIA agents to the counter-revolutionary underground in Cuba. He also worked for the Evergreen Advertising Agency in New Orleans, a CIA front that alerted anti-Castro agents to the date of the Bay of Pigs invasion by placing coded messages in radio commercials for Christmas trees. Novel himself was a paid employee of the CIA. So these guys are all. As I mentioned earlier, Novel's own lawyer, Stephen Plotkin, had admitted that his client is a CIA agent. So they're all CIA. Very Novel. There's all these characters. Let's see. And there's just tons of Ferry here. Let's move on from Jack Ruby to David Ferry. Wesley Liebler, the Warren Commission counsel who handled the New Orleans end of the inquiry, said Ferry was picked up shortly after the assassination and questioned by local officials of the FBI. I remember specifically doing up a substantial stack of FBI reports on F. Ferry that we reviewed in order to make our determination. He states the FBI reports that Ferry were not included in the commission's 26 volumes of evidence because it was so clear he wasn't involved. Why do you refuse to accept this in the explanation? So Ferry's left out of the Warren Commission. In toto, Garrison, I think it's a lovely explanation. Now perhaps Mr. Liebler will intercede with the Department of Justice and release the 23 pages of the papers of Ferry that have been classified top secret. Like, I don't think I've ever seen those in the archives. We'll have a chance to see for ourselves how clear it is that Ferry wasn't involved. Every scrap of evidence we've uncovered, and it hasn't been difficult to find, reveals not only the fact of his involvement, but the reasons for it. His politics were ultra-right wing, as I indicated earlier, but we've been able to determine conclusively that his motivation was closer to that of the Cuban exiles on the operative level, a burning hatred of Fidel Castro. When Castro was a guerrilla in the Sierra Maestra, Ferry is reliably reported to have piloted guns for him. But in 1959, when Castro started to show his Marxist colors, Ferry appears to have felt betrayed and reacted against Castro with all the bitterness of a suitor jilted by his girl. From that moment on, he dedicated himself to Castro's overthrow and began working with exile groups such as the Cuban Democratic Revolutionary Front in planning airborne missions against Castro's military installations. He is reported to have been paid up to $1,500 a mission by an ex-Batista official named Eladio Del Valle. But I haven't been able to check out Del Valle's involvement with Ferry, because on February 22, 1967, the same day Ferry died in New Orleans, Del Valle's head was split open by a hatchet, and he was shot through the heart in Miami. His murder is listed as an unsolved by Miami police. In any case, Ferry was recruited by the CIA, which employed hundreds of such people in their network of anti-Castro exile activities. From the Bay of Pigs on, he hated Kennedy as much as he did Castro. He felt that JFK had betrayed the invasion brigade by not sending in air cover. As the events I described earlier led to a detente between Russia and America, and as the FBI, under Kennedy's orders, started cracking down on the CIA-supported anti-Castro underground, Ferry's hatred for Kennedy grew more and more obsessive. Let me add here that this isn't just speculation on my part. We have a number of reliable witnesses who were privy to Ferry's thoughts at this period and saw his hatred of Kennedy develop into a driving force. After the assassination, as a matter of fact, something psychologically curious happened to Ferry. He dropped out of the anti-Castro exile activities, left the pay of the CIA, and drifted aimlessly while his emotional problems increased to the point where he was totally dependent on huge doses of tranquilizers and barbiturates. I don't know if Ferry ever experienced any guilt about the assassination itself, but in his last months, he was a tortured man. Playboy. After Ferry's death, you called it an apparent suicide, but the coroner announced that the autopsy showed death at the base of the brain, which caused a fatal Hemorrhage. Have you subsequently solved the discrepancy in your points of view? Garrison. Dr. Nicholas Chetta is an excellent coroner, and inasmuch as he found a total absence of traceable poisons or barbiturates in Ferry's system, I would respect his opinion that it was a natural death. On the other hand, I can't help but lend a certain weight to two suicide notes Ferry left in his apartment, one of which said how sweet it was to finally leave this wretched life. I supposed it could just be a weird coincidence that the night Ferry penned two suicide notes, he died of natural causes, right? I'll repeat that again. I suppose it could just be a weird coincidence that the night Ferry penned two suicide notes, he died of natural causes. Playboy. Your critics have charged that your relentless investigation of Ferry and the publicity the press gave to your charges against him induced the state of hypertension that was said to have caused his fatal hemorrhage. Do you feel in any way responsible for Ferry's death? Garrison. I had nothing but pity for Dave Ferry while he was alive, and I have nothing but pity for him now that he's dead. Ferry was a pathetic and tortured creature, a genuinely brilliant man whose twisted drives locked him into his own private hell. If I had been able to help Ferry, I would have, but he was in too deep and he was terrified. From the moment he realized we had looked behind the facade and established that Lee Oswald was anything but a communist, from the moment he knew we had discovered the role of the CIA and the anti-Castro adventurers in the assassination, Ferry began to crumble psychologically. So to answer your question directly, yes, I suppose I may have been responsible for Ferry's death. If I had left this case alone, if I had allowed Kennedy's murderers to continue to walk the streets of America unimpeded, Dave Ferry would probably be alive today. I don't feel personally guilty about Ferry's death, but I do feel terribly sorry for the waste of another human being. In a deeper sense, though, Dave Ferry died on November 22nd, 1963. From that moment on, he couldn't save himself, and I couldn't save him. Ferry could have quoted as his epitaph the last words of the Serb partisan leader, Draža Mihailović, before Tito shot him for collaboration, quote, I was swept up in the gales of history, unquote. Thank you for listening.